This is Flight Training the Way I See It with Mike Schiffer.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Flight Training the Way I See It. Opinion, news, and information for you from CFI Bootcamp and me, Mike Schiffer. I'm your host. So this is the December newsletter, video newsletter and podcast. And if you're listening, it is the 28th of December that I'm doing this, late, of course. And this is the December 22 newsletter. And the topics I'm going to discuss this week are going to be, should primary training be done in round gauge airplanes or glass cockpits? The age-old question there. I have another topic here, which is going to be the announcement of a new FAA handbook. That just dropped, so we'll take a look at that and what's in that. And then we're going to give you three pro tips this month. Again, like usual, we'll give you three pro tips about something. So that's what's on the plate. And if you don't get our newsletter, the physical copy of it, or not physical copy, the email copy of it, you can get that by going to our website and opting in for the newsletter, cfibootcamp.com. While you're there, make sure you opt into the Power Hour. We do a 1 hour, we've done 120 of these, by the way, either 119 or 120, and they are 1 hour segments on an aviation-related topic on Saturdays between noon and 1. It's a live show, and it's going to be Eastern time, so Eastern Standard Time now. So log in, get a link for that, and you'll be happy about that. It's draws between 40 and a couple hundred people, depending on the topic. Topics cover everything from ForeFlight tips, new features. We cover marketing 101 for flight instructors. There's a little bit of something for everybody in there. We did how to fly float planes, or why you'd want to in one of the episodes. So there's something in there for everybody. So go do that. That's also cfibootcamp.com. And at the top of the page, you'll see a red bar. And that's, you click onto that info or whatever it says, subscribe or info for the Power Hour, and you'll get email reminders so you don't miss one. Okay, let's dive into the content. So this is a topic that's sure to spark solid and differing opinions. Ever since EFIS was initiated, there has been, in GA airplanes, there's been this sort of argument, or it's been debated, we can call it. What's better, to fly a round gauge airplane, to learn to fly in a round gauge airplane, tailwheel airplane, you know, or a G1000, fully equipped G1000 with autopilot? What is that? So there was a time when people who trained in the G1000 were called children of the pink. I don't know if you remember that. And that was because all they knew how to do really was to follow the pink line that was part of the active leg of a GPS flight plan. So they were called children of the pink. And then there was an American Airlines training video, which is interesting, where a training captain in a video who basically said, you know, you gave us what we asked for. You know, we ask you to get people into automation and get them flying so that when we get them, we don't have to spend as much time with them. And we created a monster here because there's so much in the automation that when things go sideways, there isn't any way to do it. So that's interesting. So there's no way to recover. And they don't know about switching to different levels of automation. They just sort of blindly follow at some point. So we did make them. In fact, I had a Cirrus pilot who told me, if the autopilot fails in IMC, I will declare an emergency. I wonder if any airline captain you know, if the autopilot failed, would declare an emergency. I think answer is no. I don't think so. I know no Citation pilot would say that. Don't know any 172 pilot. Well, I know some 172 pilots that would say that, yes. Okay, so another issue was just data point. I was at the Flight School Association North America's conference in Houston, Texas, a few years ago. That's FASANA for short. And I sat on a working group that posed this exact question. So what was the answer is the question. You guys want to know who won, right? Who's the winner? Is it a split decision? That'd be interesting, right? It's a split decision. So, well, I'm going to tell you, but I'm going to go through the logic of this first, right? Here it goes. So, you know, nose-wheel airplanes, when they first got introduced, the tailwheel people all said, oh my God, look what we're turning out. We're turning out people who really can't fly. And there was no ground loop, right? So you didn't really have to learn to land as much in a crosswind. And then there was the things about coordination. And yeah, I was kind of
listening to all that and you know, the dark old days. And even Cessna in their marketing, I don't know if you know what they called the nose wheel version of their airplanes, but they called that Landomatic. Like, it would be, I think most people today would be like, it's not so automatic, but it's called Landomatic. Yeah, so it's interesting. Much easier than a tailwheel airplane to fly. And so they thought that everybody training then would be kind of dumbed down and would be create less than capable pilots, is what it was. And that all happened to an extent. That was true to an extent. Then when GPS replaced VOR as preferred navigation source or method, many said we were creating people who couldn't navigate except for using GPS. And that was about half right. They're about half right on that. And then the G1000 came along, and it was like, wow, there's a very large group of people that said it was making flying too easy. It was too much to look at. It was that. It's all automation, you know, fly the automation, only the automation. They were kind of right too. So what's missing here is, in all these cases, we could have still made a great stick and rudder pilot, couldn't we? The equipment doesn't really matter. That's the short answer. It doesn't matter. What we need to do is train up, no matter what equipment you're using, good stick and rudder skills and good navigation skills and proficiency using the technology and the automation that's in the airplane. That's what we need, all those together, not one on its own. All right, so that was interesting. And so so the thing that happened at the FASANA conference is the question came out, and there were many different opinions, and I just kind of sort of put my foot down and said, you know, the airplane doesn't matter. I said, in fact, Cessna, Piper, all these boys, girls, who are making these airplanes aren't making round gauges anymore. They're not shipping one. So they're all G1000 or all Avidyne or all something, EFAS, right? So the world is going that way. Get on the train, is what I said to them, right? Get on the train, because if you insist upon flying this, you're going to be one of those relic flight schools that just have tailwheel airplanes, which is fine if you just want to fly those and if you just want to specialize in that. But if you think the rest of the world is going to go back to those airplanes and use those as day-to-day for transportation and for flying to go see grandma, remember the picture of the guy in the pipe and everything, the hat and all this, if you think it's not going to be doing that. People want to fly nice equipment. They want to fly airplanes that are more capable. They want to fly airplanes, honestly, that are easier to fly. And so I just said, you know, get busy. Basically, it doesn't mean you change the way you teach. It means that you have to use the tool that you have and make sure the stick and rudder skills are still fully developed. And don't rely on everything automated, right? Because we don't want to make children of the pink anymore. So there's that. So let's look at some notes here to make sure I hit it all right. So another thing I think that's interesting in flying is that there's no comparison in this and to any other industry that I'm aware of. So this is something that happens. Let me tell you what happens. What happens is, as soon as something new comes along, we want to adopt it, and the newer pilots want to use it and will use it. And the older ones, the ones that have been flying a long time, will say things like, well, it's going to make flying too easy. That's exactly what we want. We want flying to be easy. We don't want it to be hard. I want flying to be such that someone with a very average or below average IQ that can make good decisions and good judgment to be able to fly an airplane. I don't want someone who needs to pass a giant PHAC, this book full of information, and understand all of it. I don't think it's necessary. In fact, I know it's not necessary, right? The reason, by the way, that you have to know all that is because you asked for and you got a private pilot certificate, which allows you to fly an airplane up to 12,500 pounds with no further testing, including turboprops. So you have to be tested at a higher level. I want a national license and just be done with that. You know, let that stand on its own. If you really want that, great. But if you want my license, a national license, the book, everything you need to know will be about that thick, right? Don't have to talk about coded weather, any of that stuff anymore. So we could take that all out. Those are all ICAO requirements. So, and then we put some reasonable limit, like 6,000 pounds or 5,000, something. Put something on there, right? And that'd be the end of it. And then it'd be a lot easier. We get more people into flying, make airplanes that are easier to fly, not harder to fly, make them more automated, not less automated. You know, let's get more people into this and not preclude it by making it so difficult, right? So that's what I have to say about it. But in the medical side of things, going back to that, so when something new comes along in medicine, they adopt it. And they take what was old out the door. Mm-mm, not us. Nope.
We find something new. We find reasons to keep the old stuff going because the people doing the testing, evaluating, and teach some of the teaching don't know how to use the new stuff, and don't want to, right? And so, therefore, we're stuck in that rut of, you know, remember the E6B? No. One of these days, I'm going to be able to say, we no longer need to teach anything about the E6B. To this day, I can't do that. I just find that fascinating that they insist upon teaching navigation using the E6B and actually using it. You know what happens there? We teach the student so they can pass the test. And the student will never use that thing one day in their life. So when they do need to rely on it, if that day comes, the zombie apocalypse comes, then they're not going to be able to use it anyway. So we're wasting time. So when Fourth Flight came along, let's use that. Right, my charts are updated all the time. I flew a Citation. We would update our charts while we were flying, because every 28 days you got a stack full, and you have to sit there and update. You want to do that again? No. Like anesthesiologists, right? They're brainwave monitors now. My friend's an anesthesiologist, actually two of them, and he says we can tell. He says without a brainwave monitor, it's not a different story. But with this, he says we can tell, and we can give you a lower amount of anesthesia if we need to. We can give you a higher amount. We can give the right balance. We can give you blood pressure medicine, that which you need, and we can kind of do that. I said, now, so raise your hand if you want to go back to no brainwave monitors and ether, right, for a surgery. Is that what you're on about? I think you'd say no. But yet, in aviation, we got these people holding us back sometimes, and we want to sort of, I understand we need balance there, and we need to be sure that people can, in fact, fly, and can, in fact, navigate. And so I think those things are training problems. Those are not problems with the technology, and they're not problems with anything or equipment. I think they have to do with the mindset of the pilot who thinks that it might be just GPS. That's all we have to know. And then hard to sell him or for them to buy in on the idea that it could be necessary to use something else, right? But creating a good stick and rudder pilot, I think most people want to be good stick and rudder pilots. So I think their ego can drive that in training. But we need to just make sure that we're training capable pilots. And the equipment doesn't matter. Okay, said my piece. Yay, let's move on. The next thing I want to talk about is the FAA has released a new handbook very quietly. I don't know why they released it quietly. But anyway, there were two ACs, and these were awful ACs. The first one was the aviation weather, which was updated maybe 2 or 3, 4 years ago, very long in the tooth, and weather theory. And then aviation weather services, you know, basically not very useful now. The aviation weather services has charts, publications, weather reports that don't even exist anymore. And, you know, there it is, full of coded information, you know. So what they did was that those were ACs. So they made a handbook, and it's called Aviation Weather, and you can get it. I posted a link in the newsletter, but you can go to FAA.gov, go to handbooks, search for handbooks, and you'll find Aviation Weather, and you find that released 2022. And so they combined those two together and stripped out information that was no longer relevant. The only thing they kept was the formatting of an AC, which I really hate. If you ever see that, they're so awful with these reference numbers every time something changes, 1.2-7, all that's populated through. This is a handbook now. You don't need that anymore. So I don't know who didn't get the memo. I didn't get to send it, so that's probably why. So have a look at that, because we'll be using that over the next number of years. Fortunately, none of our stuff at CFI Bootcamp addresses that. We don't have anything that hooks up to the old ACs. So we don't have to really do anything, which is a good thing. Those handbooks change, it's a real pain for us, really pain. All right, anyway, have a look at that. FAA.gov, Aviation Weather, it's called, okay? Now this month's three pro tips. So number one is how to stop drifting when turning crosswind to base. I find this fascinating. You know, I did so many check rides for the FAA, for the private pilot, probably 1,800, and people would do ground reference maneuvers when there is wind to do them correctly and come to traffic pattern and drift. It's just the most ridiculous thing. I just go like, oh God, why? Why is this happening? The whole purpose of the ground reference maneuver was so you could see drift and stop it. Any ground reference maneuver, except an 8-sound pylon, that is the reason. It's to stop drift. So how do you stop drift? Okay, so in the crosswind, if you're turning crosswind or base, before you turn, look out that window and see what's 90 degrees to you, that you're going to turn to. That's 90 degrees to you. Then some object out in the distance. Turn to that. Put the nose of the airplane on it. And if the heading is changing to keep that track there, then you're drifting, right? You're homing to that station, right? Or if you can do it, just put in a heading correction that you're tracking straight, even though the nose of the airplane isn't lined up to the point anymore. That's called crabbing. And that's what we want to do, right? So you can look, and if you've got the crab set right for the wind, then you'll see that when you're tracking that point that you look up way in the distance, that the airplane is not shifting track left or right from it, right? So that's how you'd know. And you do it on a base turn, too, and you'll stop drifting. It's annoying to see people drift in the traffic pattern and have no awareness of wind. You know, it's a fundamental skill, right? It's one of those things as a pilot we need to recognize. It's just not all about a crosswind takeoff and landing. There's drift in many things. How to do a better job with ATC is tip number two, and get what you want more often. First is, do not use that radio voice. You know the one. You know the one. The one that's the big boy voice, the one that you want, that sounds like American Airlines captain, that in your, I don't know, 18 or 30, and you go like, that doesn't get you anywhere. That just, you see, have you ever had any controller ever do that? No. You know why? They're professionals, that's why. Airline people do it when they are, you get that voice, by the way, when you're 40. It comes screaming right to you. Boom! It's yours to keep and hold. But anyway, that's the first thing, is get rid of that radio voice. If I hear my students have it, we're going to have a big conversation about the radio voice, especially new flight instructors. New flight instructors. Oh, Palo Alto Tower, System 24373, holding short 3-1. Indicating, I'm so comfortable in this position. This is now my new home. I'm absolutely at one with the aircraft. You know, like this kind of thing. It doesn't say that. It says, new flight instructor. Okay, that's what it says. And it's like full of themselves. So get rid of the radio voice. But that's not what I'm on about. So the controller is going to have a cadence and a pace to what they're saying, depending on how busy it is. So the controller says, 7840, Papa, turn left, heading 310, super localizer. And then 5451, Bravo, climb and descend in that pace, where there's no gaps, hardly any gaps. You don't have a chance of hell getting what you want. It's going to be slim to none that you get something, if it's super duper fast. But if there are at least a little gap here and there, controller is listening either for responses or other aircraft to check in, you've got a chance. And so you need to keep the same pace, the same cadence as the controller. So if they say 784 Sierra Papa, NorCal approach, and you say NorCal approach, 784 Sierra Papa, that's the same thing, right? And then the controller knows that you know, right? They know that you know. So that's a good thing. And then you listen for the gaps. And then when you find the gaps, say what you want. So make note of the time the controller is giving and fit what you need into that time. So if there's a lot of time, big old gap, you can say whatever you want, right? You can say, NorCal approach, 784 Sierra Papa, request flight following, destination's Fresno, route of flight's going to be direct. You have all that time. But when it's busy, then just say something like, NorCal approach, 784 Sierra Papa, or just 784 Sierra Papa, right? Request. That's it. And wait. But put it in the right place in the gap. Make sure that you're not corrupting communications between a controller and an airplane that's getting instruction, needs to read it back. Don't put your stuff there. You need to wait until it's opportunistic, right, for you. So if you put something, your request, in the middle of someone else who didn't get a chance to read it back, the controller is not going to be happy with that. And the other pilot is not going to be happy either. So mind for that. Listen for that, right? Okay, so mind the gap. Mind the gap, right? On the tube, right? Which line is it? This is a trivia question. Which line in London on the tube is mind the gap? And where is it? What station is it at? Next week, maybe. Next month, maybe I'll tell you. You'll find out. Last thing, flight tip three is flight instructors three must-dos before every flight, no matter who you are flying with. I don't care if it's Sean Tucker. I don't care if it's a DP. I don't care if it's administrator of the FAA. These are the three things you must do, or you're going to get burned one day. And I've seen it happen. I get that call. I'm the go-to guy for the call. Of course, you don't have my telephone number. But anyway, but people call me and say, and they'll say, something happened. And then they want me to fix it for them or help them. Sometimes there's no fix, right? So here's the deal. These are the things they have to do with pre-flight, right? So I've known many CFIs who thought something was done and it wasn't, with very experienced pilots having done the pre-flight. So if you're a flight instructor who just lets a student pre-flight and gets in the airplane right then and doesn't check anything, you're going to get burned. You're going to get burned soon. some point you're going to get it. maybe it'll be a while, but it's going to happen, right? So these are things you must always do. Three things. Number one, always check the fuel and the caps. I don't know how many times I've had the caps off, right? From a fuel mishap or a fueler got distracted or student got distracted or something. Caps off, right? Or the fuel was not fueled to the correct level. That's happened many, many times. Second, always check the oil every single time, right? When this didn't happen on a commercial flight, the guy was not his student. It was a Piper Aero. And what they did was they were going to need to make a night flight, do a night cross country, do some takeoffs and landings at an airport about 100 and some miles away. So the instructor did not check. The student pre-flighted, who was a private pilot already, going for commercial, they got down to this airport. They were doing a series of touch and goes, and the engine quit. And they crashed, landed, survived, everything fine, into a field, right? Why? The reason was the dipstick was left out, right, of the oil thing. There needed to be put oil in, then dipstick came out. So during that flight, oil was coming out. And eventually it got to be so little that the engine seized then. That could have all been fixed with one thing, doing this, checking the oil. Third thing is always do a complete walk around. Walk, even if you don't touch anything, make sure that you walk around and you check, you look at everything. So many times you see something missing, it's not missing, but missing like an antenna that got chipped. You can find a flight control surface that's hard to move, right? You go like, ooh, that might leave a mark. You might find somebody ran into the wing or it had a bird strike or a prop strike, not a prop strike. Well, that's true, we did have one with a prop strike that wasn't reported and they went out to do it. The student didn't pre-flight the airplane, the instructor was going out to do it. You know, so like all students, sometimes they make mistakes and they go like, did you pre-flight? Oh, yeah, they didn't do it, right? And so the prop had a big old prop strike. Yeah, that was totally unairworthy. Big Q-tip, I know how you didn't notice it, but there you go. If you do a walk around, you'll notice it. Those are three things you must do. Okay, so happy New Year, right? And I hope you had a good holiday if that's what you do. If you don't, well, I hope you sat around and drank a bunch of stuff and ate a bunch of stuff. Even if that's at least something we can do, right? And then happy New Year for the next year. We'll see what happens. We'll still be here, still doing classes, and you can see our stuff at CFIBootcamp.com. Again, join the Power Hour. It's free. We've done 120 of those. Can you believe that? 120 one-hour segments of all kinds of different things. And then if you want a copy of this video newsletter in email form with links and things you can click around to, then go to our website, CFIBootcamp.com, and opt into the newsletter. Until then, that's all for Flight Training the Way I See It. This has been a production of Flight Training the Way I See It. News, tips, and opinion.